This is Jim Inkster coming today. We'll talk politics with the man from La Politics, John McGinnis. Last night was an election night in other parts of the country. It was generally a good night for Democrats. Does this mean anything at all as we go to 2014 and Democrat Mary Landrieu seeks re-election for a fourth term in the U.S. Senate against Congressman Bill Cassidy, former Democrat turned Republican? We'll talk about this and more with John McGinnis. Also, Andrew Solomon, National Book Award-winning author. His latest is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. The New York Times says a book everyone should read. We'll talk with Andrew Solomon. And also hear from Jason Andreessen from Baton Rouge Gallery about the goings-on at the close of the year at his venue. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org by email. We begin with John McGinnis of LawPolitics.com, a man who has followed the Louisiana political winds for 40 years or more. His books include The Last Hayride and Cross to Bear, and for 20 years, starting with the Facts Weekly, he's been covering politics in a unique way and has adjusted to the times, and that he is doing as we speak. Good morning to you, John McGinnis.
Hey, good morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well.
Good, sir. Good.
Well, last night was, a good night for Democrats in national elections, picking up a gubernatorial seat in Virginia. What does that mean, if anything, as we look ahead to 2014 in Louisiana?
I guess it was, the win by Terry McAuliffe was a lot smaller margin than the late polls showed. So I think some Republicans may say it was that combined with Chris Christie's big win in New Jersey, a real triumph for the moderate Republican wing, as much as anything. That was my takeaway from the election, and we talked about that at LawPolitics.com this morning.
Well, the Democrats also gained the mayor's seat in New York City.
Right, and that was kind of, I think, a function of the crazy primary and a whole, and I think the New York City is still coming to terms with the end of the Bloomberg era. He wasn't for anybody, and I think that damaged the Republicans.
But elected a candidate who quite possibly would not do well in Louisiana.
No, probably not this guy, de Blasio. He's a New York City guy. So it'd be interesting to see the New York City, the city government, the way they're making the transition from a guy like Michael Bloomberg to an all-out liberal like de Blasio. So, I guess their politics swing a lot more widely than they do down here.
Well, one guy who was on the ballot in Louisiana who did not do well 25 years ago was Michael Stanley Dukakis, who lost to George Bush in this state and in 39 other states. But as it turns out, one of his staunch supporters, a guy who was writing letters to the editor, was a congressman of today named Bill Cassidy.
I think old Bill wishes he could take back some of those letters. He wrote a bunch of letters that he's having to look at again, and that was 25 years ago. So there's got to be a statute of limitations on the idea that you could have supported or not supported different candidates. But that fact that he wrote that letter and expressed his support for Michael Dukakis is something that's being used against him by his conservative Republican rival Ron Manis, who is, he's making still the claim he's the true conservative in this race, and though he lacks the means that Bill Cassidy has, he is still keeping that, keeping it unsettled on the right of Cassidy's ability to be able to kind of really unify the whole party behind him. And so I think maybe Cassidy, if anything, would maybe happy to see the, Chris Christie doing well in New Jersey too. There's just he can't escape the fact that he's not as staunch or a right-wing Republican, even in the way that David Vitter is, even though, and I think he probably, as far as those guys goes, he kind of held up his side, during the government shutdown, but he was shoulder to shoulder with Vitter throughout that. And I think that was as much anything that he's thinking probably a lot more right now about or as much about his rivals on the right as running against Mary Landrieu.
Now, Congressman Cassidy has called the Dukakis endorsement of 88 a youthful indiscretion. He did the same thing about his 2002 contribution to Mary Landrieu for the U.S. Senate in lieu of supporting either John Cooksey or Tony Perkins or Susie Terrell, three brands of Republicanism. And he was backing Kathleen Blanco earnestly 10 years ago in her bid successfully to defeat Bobby Jindal.
Wrote another letter there, I think.
Yeah, he was 31 when he backed Dukakis. He was 46 years old when he backed Blanco. At what point does the youthful indiscretion line have
That's a good point, and I think that's what Republican rivals or those who are not happy with him. Even John Fleming the other day said that even though he's not going to run, that there'll be more Republicans out there who will look into challenge Cassidy. But first, anyone who's looking at challenging Cassidy would, or any other Republican thinking about still getting in the race, still has to consider where are you going to get the money, even the first million, to rival the $3.5 million that Cassidy has in the bank. I know it's not all about money, but someone you have to be able to just having some grassroots opposition will attract your vote, but you're not going to displace Cassidy as the main Republican candidate without having some money behind you. So that's the problem that even Rob Manis faces, and though he was endorsed the other day by the Social Conservative Fund, the Senate Conservative Fund, those guys aren't looking to pump money into races of like this. What they want to see is someone who could write a check for $1 million and start off. And I don't see anyone out there even thinking about doing that against Cassidy. So. I think one thing it kind of all starts to point to, we're about a year out from the 2014 election, and if there still is that rival on the right, if there's still more than one Republican, I assume Rob Manis will still be in there, and if he gets even 6 or 7% of the vote, it's going to throw this into a December runoff, and will probably be the only runoff going on in the country at the time. And who knows, the whole control of the Senate may be at stake pending a December Louisiana election in 2014. That'd be a good way to kind of lead into the governor's race in 2015, I would think. We'd have the whole world watching, but, we're a long way from that. But the other scenario would be if Cassidy can't close the deal on the right and really unify the party. Is that overall lack of energy, the divisiveness, that you can have Cassidy, running against Landrieu and having to answer say that he's not conservative enough for Manis, that might just de-energize the Republican Party to the point that Mary Landrieu could take it in the primary, and that will once again foil their attempts to take her out by their not being able to unify.
We could have a late entry in Governor Jindal, although he says he's not running. But I have a question here from a listener, Jeff. He says Bill Cassidy fired Timmy Teeple as his political strategist, who is, of course, the governor's political strategist. Are there any hard feelings between the Jindal camp and Team Cassidy?
Well, we just noticed that Governor Jindal hadn't embraced Bill Cassidy yet or even endorsed him. Now, David Vitter hasn't either, but because there is another Republican in the race. But Vitter has been a lot more supportive of Cassidy than Governor Jindal has been. Vitter's and anyone that, one of those guys is close to, the other one tends not to be, because we had this Hong Kong rivalry between Governor Jindal and Senator Vitter. So that's all it plays into the dynamics of this pretty interestingly.
297-5633 for John McGinnis of Law Politics. Chris in Prairieville. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I just had a question. Just as a spectator, you know, looking at it, does Bill Cassidy really have the resume yet, and really the you know, the platform to run on against Mary Landrieu? Because, you know, it just seems like he's sort of still very new to the scene. I don't really feel like he's really made a mark for anything, and it seems like a little too quick of a jump to try and jump up to the Senate. And I understand, you know, the political climate in Louisiana is advantageous for Republicans, but, you know, she's been here as a moderate Democrat for a long time, you know, and has a lot of staying power. And I suspect that maybe there's some underestimating of, you know, her ability to hold that position.
Well, you know, things are moving pretty fast in politics these days. Cassidy was first elected to the state Senate in 2006. As I recall, in 2004, Barack Obama was a state senator, and in 2008, he was a president, you know, before he's elected to the Senate. So I wouldn't say that Cassidy is not, it doesn't have the resume. He's been a congressman now since 2009, and a state senator before that, and been above all the politics. I mean, and who's to say we have to have you have to have years and years of service before you can challenge a sitting senator. If we had it like that, there would never be serious challengers almost. So I don't know. I dispute that. I think Cassidy's been around long enough to earn the respect, he has the cred, I think, to mount a race. Now, how good a race he runs and how well he represents the Republican Party, and can he fill up the state? I mean, run as a statewide candidate instead of a congressman. Those are the challenges that Bill Cassidy has to rise to, but there's nothing in the background that says that he can't do it.
Well, Louisiana hasn't thrown out an incumbent U.S. senator since 1932, so by next year it'll be 82 years. And there are only five U.S. senators living, either current or former, in Louisiana, and they are Mary Landrieu, David Vitter, John Breaux, Bennett Johnston, and Elaine Edwards, the much-forgotten U.S. senator from Louisiana.
Boy, the inksteroids strike again.
By the way, I haven't seen Elaine in the reality show, The Governor's Wife.
And I doubt she's tuning in to A&E on Sunday night, and I wonder how many Americans are and how long that one's going to last.
Well, her daughters are certainly featured prominently, but not her sons. Now, what do you make of Edwin Edwards at least floating the idea of running for governor again?
You know, and floating's, I think, an appropriate word. The guy knows PR. You got to give him that. I mean, he's keeping himself in the public eye and promoting his TV show every time he says something like that. But I don't take it seriously. I don't think he takes it seriously. And even if he ran, certainly he would get some votes, but he wouldn't get the many votes that some people think he would get, because he will be 88 in 2014 if he ran for the Senate or the governor.
He'd be 88 and in the gate.
88 and in the gate.
Yeah, now, I think Governor Edwards is on record as saying that in the 88 election he voted for George H.W. Bush. So imagine that. 25 years ago, Bill Cassidy was more liberal than Edwin Edwards.
Another inksteroid.
Well, this may not hurt Congressman Cassidy. If it comes down to a runoff with Senator Landrieu, obviously he's going to get all the right vote. They have nowhere else to go. And he might get a little bit of the moderate Democratic vote.
Well, you're exactly right. But what he wants to do is to have and I don't think he's going to get it, is to have a whole unified party, all the oars in the water, pulling behind him. If it gets down to just a straight, and like I say, if we have a December runoff between Landrieu and Cassidy, I think he'll a lot more easily move toward the center than he is right now.
297-5633-877-217-5757. We'll return with John McGinnis. We'll talk about the 5th District Congressional race as well. And, of course, if you have any comments about the erstwhile Dukakis Democrat Bill Cassidy against Mary Loretta Landrieu Snellings next year for the U.S. Senate, we welcome your input as well. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster's show at WRKF.org. J.C. Kane is producing. John McGinnis is the guest of Law Politics for another segment. And we go to H.B. in Denham Springs. Good morning, H.B.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. John, we have a lot of important elections that's going to be occurring in our country as well as locally from between now and 2016 for the president. Do you think that voter apathy will stay about the same as it has been as history has dictated, get better, or get worse? Thank you, sir.
Good question. You know, we went through two straight governor's elections where the turnout was less than 50%, which is unheard of. You're going back to the day of the Edwards-Duke runoff of 80% registration turnout. One thing, I obviously think there is a lot more voter apathy, and there's probably a lot of reasons for it. I guess there's always that cycle swinging in the American public and in Louisiana about whether or not how much your vote counts. But another culprit, a cause why we've had lower turnouts in a lot of races is the registration is so high. We've done such a good job from voter to every different interface you have with government, you have a chance to register to vote and voter drives. Well, that signs up a lot of people who just don't go vote. I mean, you know, voting habits are is you either want to vote or you don't want to vote. And so those statistics, I think, show a decreasing turnout. You got to remember that it's against a much higher denominator. But all that being said, I do agree that there's less of a there is more voter apathy, there is less turnout, but, you know, I don't know how bad a thing that is. If people don't really want to vote, I just assume they not vote because they don't know what they're doing. Especially is it true of constitutional amendments. You know, if constitutional amendments were decided by 20% of the people, they'd probably be the ones who should be doing that. I have always had a contrary view about the idea of voter turnout. And what causes high turnout is usually anger or fear. And so I would just assume little contentment in our politics, and the people who care about elections will get out and we'll decide them, and we don't have to worry that everyone's not exercising their right to vote. Mm-hmm. They got the right, just whether they want to do it or not, it's up to them.
Well, the highest turnout, I think, in our lifetime was the 91 race with Edwards and Duke.
Right.
And
that was 80%.
80%?
Yeah, and it was interesting about that. It was 80% white, 80% black. Usually there's a gap between the white turnout and the black turnout. It wasn't in that election. And that's why I say that what brings them out is fear or anger. And, I don't know how much we need that in our politics.
Yeah. One of those who did not vote in 1991 was 20-year-old Bobby Jindal.
There we go.
Apparently there was no anger, no fear.
Bobby
Jindal.
And I'm sure he was away at Brown University.
Yeah, but, you know. There's absentee voting.
Yeah, boy.
297-5633. Senator David Vitter is teaming up with a group called Citizens United to launch a new Live By Your Laws advertising campaign. This is a TV push to pressure members of Congress and their staffs to lose their employer health insurance contributions. What do you make of this?
That's it's a great issue for Vitter, and I think it tells me that he didn't care what people think about him in Washington, because a lot of people up there, Democrats and Republicans, pretty much hate him right now, because he's forcing, in effect, a pay cut on people, not just congressmen, but their staffs. What do they have to do with this law? Even if he were to make the point that Congress ought to eat their own pudding, I guess is what Vitter says. I object to that idea that we have to personalize our laws and say because you passed something, you have to do this or that, or we're going to take away something from you, which is your employer benefits. But to lay it on the staff, too, I don't, if you want to treat the whole federal government that way and say we're no longer going to subsidize employee health care benefits like almost all big companies do, that's one thing, but to single out one branch of government and saying you guys, get a pay cut because your boss has passed a law, all that being said, Vitter still has a great issue with anyone who is doesn't like the health care law, and his own people say that the support resonates across party lines. And so all that gets back to saying, I think he doesn't care. He doesn't intend to stay in Washington much longer. He plans to come back to Louisiana and run for governor in 2015. I mean, a lot of things can change, but that's a pretty strong sign right there, because he's the one that picked up that issue. Any other Republican could have. A lot of Republicans are all falling in line behind him, but there's a lot of trepidation among them about their staffs, because this thing is getting personal. And it kind of reminds me of the way David Vitter left the Louisiana legislature with a lot of hard feelings behind him among both Democrats and Republicans over him being the architect of term limits and having made such a big stink about the Tulane scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
But he was moving on at that time, and I get the sense he's moving on now, coming on home.
And at least trying to come on home.
Well, trying to, I think he's coming on home to run.
Well, but can he come on home and become an occupant of the governor's mansion? Some say yes.
Deal. That's going to be his big test. A lot of people think, why would he do that? Maybe he doesn't like Washington anymore. Maybe he doesn't, outlived his scandal there. But as far as coming home, I kind of subscribe to the theory that it takes more than one sex scandal to sink a Louisiana politician. So David Vitter may calculate it the same way. Who knows?
I think the interesting dynamic of that 2015 race will not be, at least not at first, not John Bel Edwards going against David Vitter. It'll be Jay Darden and David Vitter going against each other for the Republican flock. George Kennedy, of course, is a take-no-prisoners political consultant who's handled every campaign for Jay Darden. And I'm sure he will not miss a beat in perusing the past of Senator David Bruce Vitter.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of perusals among the Democrats, among Republican rivals. But it's kind of a question of, it's a matter of timing and when you bring those things out. Do you do it in the primary and make yourself look like a bad guy for slinging mud at somebody else? And thereby forcing people maybe to look at a third candidate, or do you wait to the runoff and it's just you against them? These are all there'll be a lot of calculations like that going on. But it certainly is no secret to anybody. Everybody knows what the deal is. It's just how much we're going to be reminded of it.
Well, as Pat Paulson once said when he ran for president in 1968, this campaign will have rumors of the worst kind. True rumors.
True rumors. Or as Victor Skiro said, don't believe any false rumors unless you hear them from me.
Jim on the Mississippi River Bridge, you're on with John McGinnis.
John, I think you're a true Louisiana treasure to be able to anticipate and all that goes on in this state. But my question is, I have never heard it discussed in the senatorial race with Cassidy and Landrieu. What about Landrieu's seniority and the lack of seniority in other posts within the state of Louisiana? How much does her seniority mean?
You know, that seniority argument, just looking back at other Senate races, doesn't always play a whole lot back home. Sometimes people think that a lot of people respect her seniority, and that's going to work in her favor. But it's not something that closes the argument, and you've seen them. A lot of longtime senators go down in other states. As Jim points out, it's not happened here in Louisiana in over 80 years, but it's the first time for everything. But, Landrieu could make a case for her seniority. If she wins, she could be chairman of the Energy Committee. It'd be a very important committee for her to be the head of. But that sounds like a big deal inside the Beltway, but back home, it's okay, but it's not a deciding factor.
I think the biggest seniority that Landrieu has going for her is the fact that she's been on a statewide ballot 7 times, as treasurer twice, governor candidate once, and as a U.S. senator 3 times in general elections and once in a primary. So, yeah,
she's that experienced.
People are accustomed to voting for her.
That's true. That's true. And also there's a sense of a balance in politics, too. That you hedge your bet that you have you don't know who's going to be in the White House, and so it's not a bad idea to have one Democrat and one Republican in there as we have right now. So now those will be factors that will kind of work in Landrieu's favor, unless Cassidy can just really make the case against her, or if the national environment is just so bad for Democrats, and especially over the health care issue, that you know she just gets swept away. But the health care has not worked; didn't work as a big issue in 2012 when the Republicans were sure it would to help beat Barack Obama. And despite what's going on right now, I question whether it will be a decisive issue in 2014. We'll have to see.
Landrieu, in 1996, when she barely beat Woody Jenkins, and on the same day that Bill Clinton beat Bob Dole by over 200,000 votes, mind you, Landrieu carried only 25 parishes against Jenkins. And I checked the other day, I'm pretty sure in the last election with John Kennedy, she carried 39 parishes. So she's turned it around as far as winning parishes, even though the percentage, John, has not gone up all that much.
It hadn't. And also, what was different from 96 to 2008 was the Katrina effect that, you know, in 96 against Jenkins, she came out of Orleans Parish with a 100,000-vote lead and a won by 5,000 votes. Well, she's not going to be coming out of, and in 2008, she didn't come up with close that amount out of Orleans after the depopulation. But she made it up by running very well in Jefferson and St. Tammany, which are Republican strongholds, but they're also, you know, they're closer to New Orleans, and she did pretty well there. And that's right, Cassidy hopes to win this race by doing a lot better in the first congressional district in East Jefferson and St. Tammany than John Kennedy did.
297-5633, still time to chat with John McGinnis of LawPolitics.com.
We've got the 5th District congressional race going on.
That's right, and that was my segue. Clyde sides with McAllister, reads the headline from LawPolitics. We're talking about Clyde Holloway, the public service commissioner who ran a disappointing race for him in the 5th District. And this Vance McAllister is a guy certainly who isn't as much a part of the establishment as Senator Neil Reiser, who ran first in the primary. But there are people such as C.B. Forgotston who are picking McAllister to win and win big. What do you think?
Well, he's got the momentum going for him, and Reiser's trying to stop that momentum. There's a very interesting ad that people go to lawpolitics.com and look at our new section, Takeaways. We have a clip of the ad that Neil Reiser's running against McAllister right now, calling him the chameleon. That he says one thing about the Obamacare, and then he says another, Reiser's trying to use that as an issue to say McAllister is too wishy-washy on not being against Obama and Obamacare enough. It's a real interesting ad on our website. It's playing right now in Monroe. But Reiser needs something like that to stop the momentum. And now with Holloway's endorsement of McAllister, and then you have Monroe Mayor Jamie Mayo, who ran tops among the Democrats, he endorsed him, and you got Doug Dynasty, Phil Robertson, he's endorsed it too. So that's three pretty big endorsements going that are fueling McAllister's surge. He hit it at just the right time that the primary happened right after the government shutdown and frustration and anger with politics and politicians and career politicians was at a peak. And so it'd be interesting, will that be able to carry over to the November 16th election? People can get a chance to get a look at the candidates. So the debate will be Friday night. Interestingly, both of them are coming to Baton Rouge at the LPB studios for the debate. That'll be televised, I guess, in Ellic and Monroe markets, but you can view it online. So you go to lpb.org and check that out. But for some of them, the first chance to take a look at this guy, McAllister, and Reiser too, and see how that's shaping up. It kind of reflects the divisions going on right now in the Republican Party. Not exactly, but that it's kind of one, it's another one of those insider-outsider elections that are real interesting to watch.
Governor Jindal's endorsement track record, like Mike Foster, is not really that good. People, I don't really think, respond too much to politicos endorsing other politicos. In fact, they may even resent it.
Right, for the record, Jindal is not endorsed Reiser. I think he's not endorsing that race at all.
Hasn't Teeple and having other?
Well, yeah, people in effect see that, yeah, that been that connection. That, like, you know, Rodney Alexander didn't get that job at in the Jindal administration by accident, but the governor is, you know,
he hasn't
making any direct endorsement.
At least not yet.
Not yet.
And
but you're right. I doubt that he will. He's not had a good track record on endorsing candidates, and the Jindal connection is not helping Reiser in parts of that district. Not all over, but that was one of the, you know, main sticking points that Clyde Holloway, lines of attack Clyde Holloway has used against Reiser, and in endorsing Vance McAllister, I think he was trashing Reiser a lot more than he was praising Vance McAllister.
All right.
You got a little bit of three Republicans, you know, and they're all just going after each other. It's a really interesting little election. That's it. The turnout's probably going to be around 20%, which is an awful way to choose a congressman. But going back to my earlier comments, that 20% will be the ones who care.
Bud at LSU points out that in 98, 15 years ago, Mike Foster endorsed Richard Baker in a television blitz on the last week of the election, and that may have swung the election from to Baker from Marjorie McKithen. So that is a historical precedent where an endorsement did help.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So maybe we'll see Bobby Jindal come out and endorse Neil Reiser.
Yeah, well, you know, like we say, Mike Foster, that was at a peak of his popularity, too, in 1996. Mm-hmm. He had just been elected governor, and I think that was as high as he was. And Bobby Jindal doesn't have the same kind of approval rating, so I don't know if it would have had the same effect.
Well, Edwin Edwards says he used to endorse people he wanted to lose.
It's true. Well, you said that, but yeah.
I think he endorsed Jeff Diaz once in a race against Lewis Lambert for the state Senate, and he was trying to help Lambert, and it worked. But that kind of Machiavellian politics, does it still go on, John McGinnis?
Oh, I guess it goes on to some kind of degree, especially where you get the more greater involvement about consultants and like that. So, but, you know, the public sees through a lot of that stuff, too. Or they just shrug it off and don't care.
Well, you weren't high on the reality show.
No, it was a tough one. I had to watch two episodes before I could write a column, and it wasn't easy. Especially the parts when people tuning in expecting to see Edwin Edwards in his prime and popping off one-liners and the show being about him, would be sorely disappointed. He spends a lot of it kind of, you know, puttering around this house, turning the lights off, while Trina is front and center. This show's about Trina, and especially when she got on and was talking about her relationship and her hopes of having a baby, she's tearing up and joking. I was crying too, but for a different reason.
It was
a tough one, man.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, on the last show, Edwards said he was good at three things: winning elections, charming women, and barbecuing. So I think we may have Iwi barbecue coming soon.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, thank you, John McGinnis. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Always fun, Jim.
Talk to you soon. We'll be back in 90 seconds with Andrew Solomon. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. Andrew Solomon is our guest, a writer on politics, culture, and psychology. He lives in New York and in London, has written for the New York Times, the New Yorker, many other publications on a range of subjects, including depression, Soviet artists, the cultural rebirth of Afghanistan, Libyan politics, and his latest work is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon is a National Book Award winner, and the New York Times Books Review says of this one, a book everyone should read, and there's no one who wouldn't be a more imaginative and understanding parent or human being for having done so. Good morning, Andrew Solomon.
Good morning. What a pleasure to be here.
Nice to talk with you. Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. That's a big subject. And you go into great depth in your book, which is now available in paperback. It was named one of the New York Times Book Review's 10 Best Books of 2012. What about Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity? What about it is so compelling when you go into such various research into different kinds of relationships?
Well, I was really interested in trying to understand how parents respond to children who are different from them in some way. How do parents of children who are autistic, who have deafness or Down syndrome, who are musical prodigies, who commit crimes, who are transgender, and so on and so forth, make sense out of their relationships with those children? And I work from the idea that all parents have children who are in some ways different from them, and that part of the obligation of parenthood is to change your children. You educate them, you teach them to read, you teach them moral values, you teach them all kinds of things. If you didn't, you'd be a neglectful parent. But part of parenting is also accepting and celebrating your children for who they are and recognizing what the things are that are actually their nature and that you have to engage with. And I wanted to look at the tension between those two things and figure out how do all of these parents I was writing about who have children with differences that in some ways were probably unwelcome when they found out about them ultimately manage to build rich and rewarding and loving relationships with those children.
And one of the more remarkable parts of Far From the Tree is an autobiographical chapter regarding your life.
Absolutely. So the model from which I took all of this is that I'm gay, that I was brought up by straight parents, and that those parents took a while to understand who I was and to come to terms with that. And so that gave me the model for everything else. About 20 years ago, I was asked by my editors at the New York Times Magazine to write an article about the deaf. And I went off and spent time with deaf people and gained a real sense of deafness as a culture, that it's a group of people who are united by the shared use of sign language. And when I found out that those deaf people were mostly born to hearing parents, I thought how similar their situation was to the experience of gay people who were born to straight parents. And my parents had, I think, initially felt like what they really wanted to do was to cure the gayness and make it go away, and ultimately came to accept it and indeed to celebrate the family that I've been able to build in the more recent past. And I wanted to see how we all got through that and who else could learn from that experience.
Andrew was born in October of 63, just celebrated his 50th birthday. And you note that 3 years after your birth, Time magazine described homosexuality as a misuse of the sexual faculty. Times have changed for the better, but nonetheless, I would imagine there are parents and children who have issues regarding sexuality today in this country and in other places.
There are indeed. I think the struggle goes on. That Time magazine article also described homosexuality as nothing but a pernicious sickness. In the last year, the President of the United States and the Supreme Court have both expressed support for gay marriage, and I really wanted to understand how we got from there to here. How did something that had been almost universally described as a sickness come to be treated by some significant part of the population instead as an identity? A majority of Americans now support rights for gay people, gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera. So how did that shift take place? And I felt like I had been very lucky to live in a period in which the condition I had changed in its public status so much so that the tragic life that my parents wanted to protect me from when I was a child is no longer the inevitable course of life for somebody who's gay. And what were those changes? And I thought, okay, there was the women's suffrage movement, which made things better for women. There was the civil rights movement, which made things better for African Americans and other racial minorities. There's been the gay rights movement that's made things better for gay people. What other movements are there out there? Who's next in line to have their lives made better and to find greater acceptance? And I felt like a lot of the differences that I looked at, a lot of these stigmatized differences, autism, schizophrenia, Down syndrome, all of the things that I was looking at, those actually were in line to be the next for people to accept them and begin to figure out how to celebrate them.
What has been the biggest catalyst in the sea change we have witnessed on how people view, most people view gay people, as opposed to what you recited from a Time magazine story that was only 47 years ago?
Well, in the first place, I think there's been a huge change because people have come out more, and so at one point, gay people were very much hidden, and most people thought they didn't know any of them. And now gay people are everywhere, and most people recognize that they know some of them. I think media representations of gay people who now appear as regular characters on national television, I think that's made an enormous difference. I think tragic though it was, the AIDS crisis forced people to recognize how many gay people there actually are and how much of the population they make up. But I also think that really there has been this gradual opening up of society altogether, and that the civil rights movement opened up the possibility that gay people would be able to speak out about who they are and to find some kind of acceptance. And so I think the gay community has been the fortunate beneficiary of the rights communities that went before us.
Andrew Solomon is the guest. His previous work, one of them, was a 2001 National Book Award winner, and it was called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. The latest is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. All parenting turns on one crucial question: to what extent parents should accept their children for who they are, and to what extent they should help them become their best selves. Do parents have generally a hard time embracing this concept?
I think it's a journey for all parents. I feel like there are two obligations of parenthood. One is love, and that ideally should be there from the time the baby is born and should stay there all the time. And my experience is that, though we all know stories of abuse and neglect, most parents actually love their children. But the other is acceptance, and acceptance is a process, and it takes time, and it often takes parents a while to get there. So I looked at all of these stigmatized identities. I looked at deafness and dwarfism. I looked at being gay. I looked at being transgender and so on. I looked at having kids who commit crimes, and I said, how does a parent ultimately reconcile the fact that he or she loves a child with the fact that this child represents such a challenge to all of what they've expected or believed in or wanted, and what is the process by which they get there? And that's really the story of the book.
Far From the Tree is rooted in the insight that love can transcend every prejudice, and it expands our definition of what it is to be human. When you were dealing with your challenges with your parents, did you ever feel unloved?
I did feel unloved at various stages, and now that I've worked on this book, I think that my parents always loved me, but they had trouble accepting me, and I think acceptance always takes time, and I'm much more forgiving of that than I was at the time. But yes, when it was going on, there were moments when I sort of thought, but why can't you just love me for who I am? Why can't you just love me as who I am? And I think parents often don't know how to express the fact that they love a child but haven't fully accepted that child, because I think they also don't recognize that those are two different things.
You note in the book, Andrew, that love is sometimes dependent on how children are conceived, and you go into some depth about differences. Some children, of course, are brought into the world through rape. How does that change lives in our world?
So I wanted to make the argument that dealing with a child who's different in some way can have to do not only with the fact that the child has certain obvious physical symptoms that are different from what their parents have, but also can have to do with what the child does, which is why I have a chapter on families of people who commit crimes, or with where the child comes from, which is why I have the chapter on families of children conceived in rape. And what I found in looking at rape was that it presents an impediment to the family fully embracing and accepting their child, but that ultimately, over time, a lot of these parents, a lot of these mothers who have gone through this terrible trauma and who have felt that they didn't want this child and that they were stuck with this child and are miserable with this child, form a real bond with the child, because the child is his or her own person and is not merely a reminder of the rape that came before. So I would never want to trivialize the difficulty of those experiences or to suggest that they don't represent an enormous challenge, but I really feel that a lot of the families, I mean, there was one woman who I interviewed who said to me, quite amazingly, she was at 50, she had been brutally raped at 16, it had derailed her life in various ways. I said to her, do you still think about the man who raped you? And she said, well, I used to think about him with rage, but now I think about him with pity. And I said, pity? And she said, yes. She said, because he has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one.
USA Today says of Far From the Tree, a masterpiece of nonfiction, the culmination of a decade's worth of research and writing, and it should be required reading for psychologists, teachers, and above all, parents. Rose in Sherwood Forest, please be brief,
yes,
Rose.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. Does your book deal with mental illness and how that can affect a child if a parent is mentally ill?
My book is really about how parents respond to having children who are different in some way. So So it goes on at some length about how it affects parents to have a child who's mentally ill, but it's not focused on how it affects a child to have a parent who's mentally ill.
Does the research, the voluminous research that was involved in Far From the Tree, does it dovetail with your previous works about depression?
I think all of my work is about how people manage to take circumstances of extreme adversity and turn them into an occasion for dignity and even for joy. And I felt like the depression book was about the idea that while nobody wants to be depressed, there are actually a lot of lessons to be learned from that difficult experience. And this book is about the idea that while nobody sets out wanting to have a disabled child, there are many people who, once they have children like that, find a great deal of meaning in it. So that one mother who has a child with Down syndrome said to me, "I would never have believed I would ever think this 23 years ago when my son was born, but having him has given me so much more purposeful a life, made me so much better a person than I would have been without this, that though I would change his Down syndrome for him to give him an easier life, speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world."
The book is Far From the Tree, from Andrew Solomon, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Thank you, Andrew.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Take care, and talk to you soon. And we're joined in studio now by Jason Andreessen, the executive director of the Baton Rouge Gallery, the crown jewel of City Park. How many years now?
How many years?
For you?
For me, since 2007.
Well, that's 6 years.
Yep.
That's a commitment.
That it is.
And the gallery is one of the real wonders of our community. And you got any information on the number of people who go there every year?
We're typically somewhere around 16,000-17,000 per year.
16,000-17,000. Of course, you got a golf course right outside the doors.
We do. And we do. We're very blessed to be inside Breck's historic city park, and a nice, wonderful place to come to work every day.
And I'm sure you like looking out over the golf course.
I do.
Yeah. And the atrium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The entire grounds are beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful. It is a spectacular place. And you've got some events coming up soon and very soon at Baton Rouge Gallery, starting with Kinetics.
Kinetics, Friday night. It's our annual benefit, the one fundraiser that the gallery has per year. Outside of that, we really focus in on exhibitions and programming and trying to advance the arts in our community. But for this one night, we have this event called Kinetics, where we invite business leaders, arts lovers, community members to come out and enjoy the arts and kind of celebrate the mm-hmm. impact that the arts have in our community.
Kenneth Brown, who's been on this show, is going to be front and center for Kinetics. You got a good one.
Absolutely.
You know, well, for those unfamiliar, he is one of the more well-known and decorated interior designers and former HGTV stars.
So. He had his own show on HGTV for a time. He's also designed some big-name celebrities' homes, and we're looking forward to having him serve as a special guest MC for the night.
And some of the best artists in the region will be represented with Kinetics.
Absolutely. So. It's the area's premier live art auction. The live auction is really sort of the star of the show that night. We'll have over 30 original pieces from artists all over the state, and the bidding opens at just $100.
Okay, and for those who would like to be there at Baton Rouge Gallery?
You can go to batonrougegallery.org/kinetics, and there you can buy tickets. You can see all of the works that are up for bid. You can also find out about our new feature this year, the Kinetics Raffle. With just a $5 raffle ticket, you can win one of four amazing prize packages, each one valued over $2,000.
That's Friday night. Get started what time?
7 o'clock.
Okay. Jason Andreessen, the executive director of Baton Rouge Gallery at 1515 Dalrymple Drive for the last 6 years. You've got something, well, you always have events there. I notice coming soon, England in 1819?
Yeah, we have a new feature we're going to test out on Friday, December 6th, called Live at the Gallery, where we're partnering with a group called American Thrift. We'll be bringing in the band England in 1819. They've also selected, I believe, five or six artists to show their work in the gallery, sort of in advance of their performance, and they'll actually be using some of the footage from their performance for an upcoming music video.
That's December the 6th, 1 month from tonight, at mm-hmm. Baton Rouge Gallery, 7 o'clock. But the Kinetics, the big event of this year, is this Friday, November the 8th, at the Baton Rouge Gallery. What else is going on before we round out 2013?
Well, Kinetics is really our big event for the rest of this year. That's sort of the lion's share of our focus at the moment. But then for the rest of 2013, we'll be focusing in on getting ready for Surreal Salon 6 coming up in January. It's a show that features pop surrealist work from all over the country, and it'll be actually juried by Greg Escalante, who's the co-founder of Juxtapose Magazine.
All right, we've got a question about Movies on the Lawn. Will that continue?
Absolutely. Movies and Music on the Lawn is going nowhere. It'll start back up in May of 2014 and go through September.
Any ideas on what movies we'll be watching and music we'll be hearing?
We've got ideas for days, but we're not going to give that away
all
just
right,
yet.
So Kinetics is first up Friday night at the Baton Rouge Gallery. Thank you. And if you'd like to call 383-1470, 225-383-1470 is the number for the Baton Rouge Gallery. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.